Professor Burr, Criminal Procedure 1, November 4, 2008, podcast number 8, room number 238.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, now we can start. So, a couple of administrative things before we jump back into confessions. I think when I counted classes and told you we only had 10 classes left, I think I undercounted. Because it seemed like that was a long time ago, and we still have 8 classes left. Looking at your syllabus, I think there will be probably only 2 to 3 more blocks of reading after what you have in your syllabus. And I'll announce that probably in like 3 more classes. There's nobody who's already read. You probably don't want to confess this in front of your classmates. If you're dying to know what the next reading is after block 19, let me know. Otherwise, I'm going to hold off on announcing it until I see how long it takes us to get through confessions. The other administrative matter is the exam. Some of you have already started to ask about the exam. It seems a little early to be... I don't know. I never know of how... If what the exam looks like affects how you study, I was never one of those people, I guess. But I guess to the extent some people study differently for different kinds of tests, there's no point in me hiding details about the exam. So if you don't want to hear any of this because it stresses you out, just earmuffs. If you do want to hear it, the exam for this class is 3 hours long. I think it's the very end of the exam period, because they do that to me every year, make my exam last. It will be 75% multiple choice. It will be 25% will be based on one essay question. So 3-hour exam, 75% multiple choice, 25% essay. It is closed book except... for 5 pages of notes. 5 pages of notes. You can bring in 5 pages of notes. I don't care what 5 pages they are. One-sided only. Normal size. 8.5 by whatever this size is. Okay. Do not bring in poster board and say you didn't know. Okay. 5 single sides of paper. If you want to make that, you know, 4 font and squint at it for 3 hours, you're welcome to do that. If you want to bring in a poem that makes you calm and breezy, do that. I don't care what the 5 pages are. Okay, but only 5 pages of paper, single-sided, normal-sized pieces of paper. Okay. Are there any questions about the 3? You guys have taken exams before. 3-hour exam, you don't have a lot of time to be checking notes. Okay, the way I look at your, if it were me, my 5 pages would be a very bare bones outline so that in case you completely freak out and remember, oh my God, there was one more exception to the search warrant requirement, and I can't remember it. Something that just triggered that memory really fast. You're not going to be able to learn something you didn't already know during a 3-hour exam. Okay, so you should study as if it is a closed book exam, in my opinion, and put whatever you need on those 5 pages to just trigger your memory so you don't miss an issue or just completely space out and forget about something. Yeah.
How many questions are involved in
this? I don't know yet. What I do is once I have the exam written, I put the instructions to the exam. Not the exam. The instructions of the exam up on TWIN, so you can read the instructions ahead of time, know how many questions there are, all of that. It's usually something like not quite 40 questions, something like that, for 75% of your time of 3 hours, which is 2 hours and 15 minutes. You'll have the entire exam accessible to you for the 3 hours, so you don't have to... Your time can be allocated as you choose, but my assumption is that people spend 25% of their time on the essay, the rest of the time on the multiple choice. Obviously, if you power through the multiple choice and you've got tons of time left over, you can use all that time on your essay and vice versa. Okay. We'll talk about this more, you know, right the last class, you know, we'll talk about it again. But Yeah. There's sample multiple choice questions, and I think the way I have it set up, I've got to look at this, actually. I think the way I've got it set up is that there's sample multiple choice questions on the website, and then it says that the answers are on TWIN. So I still need to put the answers up, because my thinking is if I just give you multiple choice questions and the answers are right there on the same page, there's a tendency to go, oh yeah, I knew that, like, without really testing yourself. So I'll make sure that the answers to those questions are on TWIN. I've got to remember to do that. All right, any other questions on that? All right. It's early to be talking about this. I don't want people to start freaking out and thinking more about the exam than the material. But one thing I would, as a strategic matter, you might want to do the essay first, right? Because if you're going to run out of time, if you run out of time and you don't get to your essay, you get a zero on your essay. If you run out of time on the multiple choice, what do people do when they run out of choice? You pick A, B, C, or D, and you just start. Okay, you can at least guess. You can't guess on an essay. So I would, if it were me strategically, I would try to use my time. I would try to get as much done with the essay quickly, and then you bank your time for the multiple choice. Strategically, I would do that. But do what you want. Okay. All right. Any questions on that unpleasant stuff before we get back to fun stuff? I went to a hippie college, like, where they didn't give you grades and never talked about tests. So I'm always uncomfortable talking about this stuff. I know it's very, very important, obviously, but if it were up to me, I would just talk about fun stuff and not give you a test. Okay, so the scope, you guys like that idea. Yeah, I would run our ranking right down to the ground. A law school with no grades, no tests. Self-incrimination, we finished up talking about the basic privilege against self-incrimination, which is in the Fifth Amendment, and also extends to the state through the 14th. No person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. And speaking broadly, I think we covered three main issues that you need to keep in mind with the privilege. One is the scope of the privilege. It applies only to testimonial evidence. So if a person is not being compelled, if they're being compelled to give something that's not testimonial, like fingerprints, like blood, like being subject to a search warrant, like a handwriting exemplar, being forced to stand in a lineup, okay, all of those things that are physical and not testimonial, that doesn't implicate the privilege at all. So therefore, it can be compelled, right? If it is testimonial, it implicates the privilege. If it implicates the privilege because it's testimonial, the defendant can't be punished. Sorry, one, he can't be compelled to do it, right? And then two, along with that, he can't be punished if he refuses to do it. Okay, so can't be compelled, and if he doesn't do it, he can't be punished. The two kind of issues you'll see come up with punishment are contempt, right? A person can't be held in contempt for refusing to testify against himself. But he also can't be punished indirectly. Like, for example, an adverse inference. The jury can't be told, the defendant didn't testify at his trial, therefore you can infer he must be guilty. That's not permissible. Also, indirect punishment. A prosecutor cannot comment during a criminal trial on the defendant's silence. That's also a form of punishment the court held. So prosecutors are not supposed to argue to the jury they must be guilty because they didn't testify. We did talk about how prosecutors might flirt with that line by saying, you know, what has the defense done to rebut this powerful case? Something like that. Okay, but as long as the rule is that they can't be commenting adversely on the defendant's silence. Okay, so one, it has to be testimonial. Two, no compulsion or punishment. And three, was losing immunity. Okay. So, losing the privilege because of immunity. Prosecutors can take away a defendant's privilege against self-incrimination by taking away the threat of incrimination. It's enough to take away the threat of incrimination by promising the defendant use and derivative use immunity. The prosecutor does not have to confer, you know, the golden ring of immunity, which is transactional immunity, upon the defendant. As long as the prosecutor promises, we will not use your statement against you, and we won't use anything against you that is derived from that statement, that's good enough. The person loses his privilege, and at that point can be compelled, okay, to give testimony. All right, were there any questions on that?
That's just the perception of duty, right?
No, they don't have to accept. It's forced upon them. Yeah, that's the whole point of this. Even if they don't take it, even if they say, no, I don't want to testify because Tony Soprano's a bad guy and it's going to whack me if I tell you what happened, the prosecutor can force them to testify as long as they get use and derivative use immunity. If that person continues to say, no, I'm not going to testify because Tony Soprano's a bad guy and he'll whack me if I do, he could be held in contempt at that point. He could be punished. Okay, at that point, I mean, just... I'm glad you brought that up, Nicholas, because it raises that practical situation where you might... We're talking about formally, doctrinally, what is the rule? The rule is that the defendant loses his privilege if he has use and derivative use immunity, and even if he doesn't want it, even if he's holding out for something better, like transactional immunity, like witness protection, or something affirmative that inures to his benefit. When that happens... The doctrine gives him no comfort. I mean, the doctrine says you've lost your privilege. In reality, it becomes a battle of the wills, right? Where this guy says, fine, do what you're going to do. Hold me in contempt. Or he'll lie and say, fine, I don't know anything. Tony Soprano wasn't there. Prosecute me for perjury if you want. Okay, so it becomes a battle of the wills where then the prosecutor, to get that person to cave, to get that person to say what the prosecutor wants him to say, and what the prosecutor thinks is the truth, the prosecutor might come up with transactional immunity, might come up with a better deal for him criminally, might come up with witness protection or something affirmative that inures to his benefit, might give immunity to his wife, you know, all of these things that the defendant is looking for that he's not entitled to under Castigar. Okay. We then turn to our big project now is to look at all of the different ways a defendant might try to suppress a confession. And we talk first of all about due process, just the basic due process argument under both the Fifth Amendment and 14th Amendment. And here the defendant would move to suppress his confession on the basis that it's involuntary. It's the other, it's whether or not his confession was made voluntarily or not. We talked about, this is totality of the circumstances, of course. We talked about what some of those issues, what some of those factors might be under the totality of the circumstances, like the duration of, broadly, right, psychological pressures put upon the defendant. And that might include isolation, having him be tired, right, fatigue, the length of the interrogation, using friends against him, depriving him of food, his kind of psychological pressures, isolating him. We talked about one very heavy factor in the totality of circumstances, if there's any actual physical force or even a threat of physical force, that's going to weigh very, very heavily. If the trial court believes that that happened, a defendant was either subjected to physical abuse for refusing to talk or told that he would be subject to physical abuse if he didn't talk, it's going to be pretty hard to say that that's voluntary at that point. Also, that what goes into the mix is the individual characteristics of the defendant, so age, education, any kind of special psychological vulnerabilities, and particularly if the government is preying on that. And let me circle back up to that in a second, put a little dot there for us to come back to that. And then we also talked about promises of leniency. There's a tendency for courts to distinguish between true promises of leniency and false ones, so that it's one thing for, if they say, you know, we'll only prosecute you for a misdemeanor instead of a felony if you tell us the truth, and they are going to stick with that, a court might say that's a voluntary choice. The person actually got a pretty good deal because they took the government's leniency. If, however, what the government is doing is lying and saying, we'll give you immunity if you confess to murder. I mean, let's make it extreme. We won't prosecute you if you confess to murder. And then he confesses and then try to prosecute him for murder anyway, a court's likely to say, We don't think that's a reliable confession. It's involuntary. Even an innocent person would have confessed because they were told, but it wasn't even going to be used against them. So you've got to look at that as a factor in the mix. And then finally, deception, and we'll get to that too. So if you're keeping track of these factors, I think the ones we need to explore in a little more detail than we did last week are the characteristics of the defendant and also deception. On characteristics of the defendant, we didn't talk about Colorado versus Connolly, which is a pretty important case in your book at... it's bottom of 685. This case is pretty unusual, to say the least. The defendant had committed a crime in Boston, I think, up in the Northeast, and then is in Denver, right? And just on his own, walks up to a uniformed police officer in downtown Denver and just starts confessing to a murder that this police officer in Denver doesn't know anything about. At that point, I'm just picturing this uniformed police officer suddenly has this person like telling him about a murder. The uniformed police officer at that point says, whoa, 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 wait a second, and warns Connolly that he has a right to remain silent and that the statement can be used against him. And Connolly just plows through it, just keeps on going, keeps on saying all of this stuff that incriminates him. Well, it turns out that Connolly's mental faculties are a little questionable. The next day, he's all disoriented and kind of sounds crazy and said that the reason why he confessed to the police officer was that he heard voices that told him to confess. Well, the Colorado Supreme Court suppressed the defendant's statement because the confession wasn't a product of his free will. Right? The Colorado Supreme Court says this isn't voluntary. It was the product of his insanity. He thought voices were telling him he had to confess, and that's why he confessed. It wasn't because he wanted to. It wasn't voluntary. The Supreme Court reverses, and the majority says that the confession is admissible. Why? And no one was disputing the fact that this, I mean, the record was pretty clear that this guy was Looney Tunes. Yeah. Okay, why does it matter that the government didn't ask anything of him, that Connolly just walked up to the police officer and just started speaking on his own? Yeah, the one thing I would change about that, he said no one forced him to talk. Well, his own demons told him to talk, right? It wasn't voluntary in the sense that we would talk about somebody doing something voluntarily. I think what's critical in Connolly is the government didn't induce him to confess involuntarily. Maybe his confession was involuntary in some sense, some kind of psychological sense. But the government did not induce him to confess involuntarily. There was no state action as the way the court sees it. So I think the lesson of Connolly is that the confession to be suppressed on due process grounds has to not only be involuntary, but it has to be involuntary as a product of government conduct, not involuntary because of some other reason. So if the defendant's crazy and confesses, or presumably if the defendant is pressured to confess because of someone else, a spouse, if it has nothing to do with the police, if it's not tainted by police or government action, I think you would apply Connolly and say, for due process purposes, it's voluntary. Even though, you know, if you separate it from that state action requirement, you might say in some sense it's involuntary. Does that make sense? Okay, there's got to be something about what the government is doing that makes it involuntary. The other point we didn't get to in much detail was talking about deception. this happens all the time. I wanted to just flag something that was in your book. On the bottom of page 682 of your casebook, kind of going over to page 683, your casebook editors do a pretty good job of just summarizing a few other independent sources on what these confessions tend to look like. Has anybody ever, hopefully you have not been subject to interrogation, has anybody ever witnessed an interrogation? Have you ever, for some reason? You have? What was that like? Oh, okay. It was by military police? Okay. But it's, I assume you mean something other than sometimes I tell my husband, why are you interrogating me? I don't think you mean that, right? You mean some kind of investigative sort of
thing.
Yeah. But what was the dynamic of it? Was it friendly?
Sort of.
Was the person cooperative? Okay. Were the people interrogating him using tricks and stuff like that, or not really?
Sometimes.
Okay. So the dynamic of these, I've seen a few interrogations before, and I'm always surprised by the tone they strike. But the detectives who are really good at this, and there are some who are really terrible at it, and there are some who are really good at this. And what I mean by good at this is they get people talking without doing things like hitting them with phone books and stuff like that. They're really good at reading people and just sort of seeing what it is that's going to work with them. And sometimes just being very friendly to a person, if a person is kind of a passive person and wants to please, sometimes just being nice to a person. A detective will be super nice and like go get them soda and get them their favorite kind of sandwich and be all buddy-buddy with them. And that might be a way of, it is a psychological trick to an extent, right? The detective's not their friend. They're not looking out for their best interests, okay? But that's not going to render a confession involuntary at all. If anything, it's going to help show it's voluntary. It's all low-key, it's friendly, detectives being super nice and asking about their family and all this stuff, okay? Being nice. Other times, it's much more confrontational. And it's more like what you see in TV where they're like in the box and the police are confronting them with all the evidence against them saying, how can you deny this and all this stuff. And I think your casebook does a pretty good job of just kind of summarizing some of the really common tricks. And one of the really common tricks is to lie about the strength of the case. So it's not uncommon at all to confront a suspect with evidence that doesn't exist. Okay. We found the murder weapon, or we found your blood there, even if it's not true. It's extremely common if you've got cohorts, right? If you have two people in custody, and they are believed to have committed the crime together, to separate those two and tell each of them that the other has already flipped, when in fact neither one of them has flipped. Okay, well, if they think the cat's already out of the bag because their friend flipped on them, they're going to want to give their side of the story so that everything's not mounted on them. Okay. Yeah.
You watch a show on the Andes, verse 48.
Yeah, I
see that. You can see this. I mean, see everything on there. On like almost everything.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, and there's a lot of tricks. And it's only one factor in the totality of the circumstances. There is no prohibition against lying to defendants. It's considered what the police do. It's extremely common. It'll be one of the factors in the totality of the circumstances. But that in and of itself is probably not going to make a confession involuntary. Now, I have to say probably, because whenever we're talking about totality of the circumstances, right, whenever we're talking about a standard and not a rule, there is a possibility that some trial court will say that rendered it involuntary. Too many lies. What's his name? Brandon Tankless?
Okay.
Marty Tankless. So, does anybody remember what the police told him to get him to confess?
His father's mother told him that he did it. They said that he did it.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is pretty horrible. This is one of the more disgusting things I've ever heard. This kid was saying, I didn't, you know, he's accused of killing his parents. I mean, if you didn't do that and you're accused of that, it's pretty horrendous. He's saying, I didn't do it. They told him his dad was still alive when he wasn't, and then told him, your dad told us you. Well, a kid told my father, just, I'm my father saying I did this to him, he might say, well, maybe I did. Maybe I blacked out. Maybe there must be some explanation if my dad is saying that. But in fact, his dad never did say that. Pretty disgusting stuff. So you can see how, and I could go on and on. I find this stuff very fascinating. My own view is that when police do that, the police aren't told not to do this stuff. If anything, they're told that they should do this stuff. The really good detectives get people to confess. They're supposed to be smart. They're supposed to outwit the defendant. And they believe the suspect is guilty. Right? I mean, if they didn't think that, they wouldn't be doing this stuff. They believe they've got the guy. In their mind, they're looking at some kid who just killed his parents. I mean, they're looking at him as the total scum of the earth, and if they have to trick him to get him to tell the truth, they're going to trick him. Well, the problem is if they're wrong, if they don't have the right person, they might be tricking somebody into saying something, even if they're innocent. So I think this stuff is pretty fascinating, but I wanted to point out some of those tricks that the police quite commonly use, and it's only part of the totality of the circumstances. Okay, I wanted to look at this Monica Lewinsky tape, not because, you know, it's the most compelling interrogation in the world, but it's a unique situation, I think, to get a case that you guys aren't familiar with, right? Everybody knows who Monica Lewinsky is and her place in history for whatever. But you can see the Form 302, those pages that I assigned to you off the internet. That a Form 302 is just the name of what the FBI uses to, it's their witness reports. Okay. But it's the 302 from the day they questioned her for the first time. They confront her after they've been talking to Linda Tripp and everything. Monica Lewinsky doesn't know about any of this, and then they confront her all of a sudden and talk to her about her relationship with Bill Clinton at that point. And I think it's really interesting to contrast the kind of cold documentation in the 302 with what she describes. And I don't think, my own view on this is no one's lying. You can take what she said and just, you have my permission to pull up on the internet, okay, that form if you didn't print it out, and look at what she says compared to that form. And I like this documentary. It was an HBO documentary. And while she's talking about that day, they even, you'll see at the bottom of the screen, the producers have taken parts of the 302 and they'll quote it, like with the time and what the agents wrote down in the 302, and it'll match what she says, but it's such a different depiction of two sides of the same story. So hopefully this works.
Trying to get Linda to change her mind about being forthcoming about my relationship with the president in her testimony in Paul Jones' case. And we met at Pentagon City Mall in the food court, and her sister made it one. And she was late, and I was incredibly anxious, and I saw her coming from Pentagon City Mall. The food court is on the bottom level, and it's an open mall that has, I think, four levels. So I could see her coming from the second level to go to the escalator to come down. So I started to walk over towards her, and she walked over here, and I met her. And she motioned behind her, and Agent Fallon and Agent Irons stepped forward and flashed their badges at me and told me that I was in trouble, that the FBI was investigating issues or matters related to the Paula Jones case, and that they wanted to talk to me about this matter. They had lawyers upstairs in the hotel room, and they just really wanted to talk to me and give me an opportunity to decide if I wanted to cooperate and help myself, because I was in trouble. So, I was pretty frightened. I was pretty shocked. started to cry. Linda tried to hug me. And I did the only thing that had come to my mind. I didn't know very much about the law, but what I had seen from TV and the movie was, I'm not talking about that one. And Lee said, well, that's my agent. I said, well, that's fine, but you should know that if your attorney's present, we won't be able to give you as much information. You won't be able to help yourself as much. So, why is that funny?
Yet, out of my silence.
was just crazy. And I was hysterical, and I cried, and I wanted to die. And I just felt that my whole life was ruined. I couldn't imagine the present state, when he was going to hear that all this had happened. And I couldn't imagine my family having to see all of this and hear all of this, and I was going to go to jail. And I know, and there, it's like so many people always come up to me and they go, you weren't really going to go to jail. You know, you didn't really think that. And I don't know how to explain to anybody how when a prosecutor is telling you, an FBI agent is telling you that you're going to go to jail, you feel that way. And you don't, you know, arrest and put you in jail. At some point, one of the agents started to read me my Miranda rights, and then I slipped down again because I knew once again from TV and movies that that's like the part when they arrest you. So I didn't, I mean, it's just, it was just, and I sit here, and I, it doesn't even feel real anymore sometimes. Ken Starr said nothing happened in that room, and I was treated with respect and dignity. I'm sorry. I feel like I need some water.
One of the reasons your agents held Ms. Lewinsky was that they
that was I have to hope that is the
That
is false, and you know it to be false.
Well, I'll rephrase the question.
She was not helped
during her sojourn with your agent.
Well, the Ritz-Carlton is a very pleasant place to have a sojourn.
It was sort of obvious that I wasn't going to be able to call a lawyer, much like Frank Carter. I said, well, can I call my mom? I mean, at least it was someone. And it was, they just sort of kept hedging. It was, we really, you know, we just don't know that we'll be able to offer you this deal if you tell someone. But then Jackie Bennett came in and they all sort of filed in, so it was about, maybe about nine people or so, and he basically laid it down and said, you're 24, you're smart, you don't need to call your mommy, and you should know that, you know, if you don't cooperate, we're planning on prosecuting your mom, too. So, I broke down again. And they finally let me call her, and then they let my mom come down, and waiting for her to get there, it was bad weather, and it took a long time. It, 1 minute would pass, and it felt like an hour, and I was getting claustrophobic in the room, and it was just crazy. And so I tried to change tactics with them. You know, maybe they see me as a person, they won't prosecute me. So I'm charming and funny and I'm nice. They'll decide that they can't do this. And so we walked around the mall. We went to dinner. I at one point went to the bathroom and there was a payphone in there, and I tried to call Betty Curry in the payphone, and she didn't answer the phone. And I remember seeing this mother and her baby, and standing there, and I thought, okay, maybe I'll ask this woman to give her Betty's number and have her call and tell her something. I mean, I'm trying to think of all these things, because all I was thinking about was that the president's deposition was tomorrow. And they were setting a perjury trap for him, essentially. He didn't know that this investigation was going on. I assumed he was going to go in. He knew I had signed an affidavit, so I assumed he was going to go in and deny the relationship. I thought he just had to know. He had to know. angel walking in the door. I felt 5 years old again. You know, that feeling like you just, not the thing you feel towards your parents when you're an adult. And I'm just so grateful to see her and to see someone familiar and someone that I knew. My mom called my dad. My dad had been out of this meeting in California. He knows nothing of what's going on. They're threatening my mom.
She basically loses it at that point. She's got to go away for a while. So that's all she says about that. So for our purposes, I mean, everybody knows what happened in reality, right? Her lawyer did get involved. She arranged immunity for herself in exchange for her testimony in front of the grand jury. And Bill Clinton did the next day deny the relationship in the Paul Jones deposition, hence his impeachment. Okay, so for our purposes, let's assume all that happens and she winds up that night confessing to lying in her affidavit, and then they then seek to use that against her. They then seek to use her confession in a perjury false statements prosecution against her. What would her attorney say about the voluntariness of that confession? Okay, so she was there for about, 9 hours? So, 9 hours, that's a long time. What else?
I think it
would
go to the individual characteristics of the day. Clearly, she had no idea what was going on, or she wasn't happy enough to
So she's got no knowledge of the law. Yeah.
Well, could you say that cuts the other way though? Is she's not really what the court is saying on any case? What's happening? She might not know the law, but she knows that she has a right to return. She said that she's seen that, whether she saw it on TV or not. She has some knowledge of what's going on. I think there's only one look at that. They're looking for like somebody who's 40 years old with a second grade education and can't read.
Yeah, compared to your typical person on a criminal docket, Monica Lewinsky's pretty sophisticated. She's college educated. She met her boyfriend working in the White House. Right? Smart enough to work in the White House, apparently. Has a private lawyer. Most arrestees don't have such things. What other things do we need to put up here on which side of the board? Yes. They threatened her with 27 years. Yeah.
They ignored her request for a lawyer.
They ignored her request for counsel, telling her, well, we're here to see if you want to cooperate with us, and we can't give you that deal if your lawyer is involved. Threaten that to go after her mom if she doesn't cooperate. Anybody gonna say anything different?
Yeah. On the other side, they did give her water and a towel.
All the bottles of water, right? That's written in those 302s for a reason. Why do you think some FBI agent takes the time to write Ms. Lewinsky a bottle of water?
Because they're going to say that everything was, you know, she was asking for water, we were giving her water, she was comfortable, it wasn't this adversarial thing, it was more like a friendly conversation.
They turn on the air conditioner at her request, they make sure to write that down. They give her a towel, they write that down. Every time she wants water, they write that down. Yeah. mall, getting dinner, right? She goes by herself to the bathroom, to the ladies' room. And they're going to say all of this low-key. It was not confrontational. You saw how upset Ken Starr got. She wasn't held. She was not held. Very clearly, they were taking the position that she was not in custody. Yeah.
What about the psychological
Yeah, she said there was something like up to 9 people at one point with agents and also the special prosecutor, Bennett, who worked for Ken Starr. Two of Ken Starr's prosecutors were there, I believe. So it's all these people against her. Yeah. Which way does that cut?
I don't know.
Well, okay, when we start talking about Miranda, this is a really interesting point, right? On the one hand, you could say reading her Miranda rights shows that they were telling her that she had the right to remain silent and have the right to a lawyer, and maybe that makes it more voluntary if she chooses to talk. How did she see it, though? Was she glad to be read her rights?
She saw it as an indication that she was in trouble.
She saw it as an indication that she was under arrest. We'll revisit this when we get to the doctrine on the black letter law on Miranda, which we're not to yet. So Miranda kind of plays in here, and you could, and in practice, this is how it will cut. The government will use the reading of Miranda rights on the due process question, right? Even though doctrinally they're two separate inquiries. On the due process question, they'll argue that if the defendant was read his Miranda rights and spoke anyway, that shows that he was doing it voluntarily, because he was told he had a right to remain silent and didn't. Defendants will try to cast Miranda as something that actually weighs against them by saying it was intimidating, that they at that point believed that they were under arrest. They didn't feel like they were there voluntarily, although it's one thing to go from being there, you could be there voluntarily and yet your speech still be voluntary. Okay, so one factor is going to be cast differently by the two sides of litigation. We're missing a couple. How does all this start?
Okay, well, how does that kind of move from, I think, the government within the
Yeah, all this, I mean, they take her to Burgess Carlton instead of to a federal building for a reason, right? They want to be able to say she's not in custody, this is all low-key, it's in this fancy place, she got dinner at the mall, she gets water, she gets air conditioning, we were pampering her, nobody was threatening her. Yes.
So when the agents first approached her, they started off by saying, you're in trouble, and called us.
Right, the whole thing starts with like letting her know that the jig is up, right? They don't go through a lawyer, they don't contact her on her home territory, right? They do this when she thinks she's having lunch with Linda Tripp. I mean, think about it, she's a relatively young person. She's about the age you guys are now, right, when all of this is happening. She thinks she's going to lunch with her friend, and what she finds is that her agent saying, guess what, your worst nightmare has just happened, and you are now in the middle of an international scandal and legal problem, and that's kind of thrown on her by surprise. And they're clearly meaning to surprise her, I think. That's a tactical decision on their part. What about Linda Tripp? Where does she go in all this? What's the government going to say about Linda Tripp's involvement in this?
I was going to say maybe having her there was like a support staff. Like, I mean, that might weigh in the government's favor, because they let her have the friend who was there and that was a source of support for her.
Right. The government's going to say she was not incommunicado. She wanted Linda Tripp with her at first. We let her bring Linda Tripp. She wanted to call her mommy. We let her call her mommy. Mommy wanted to call daddy. They called daddy. We let them do whatever they wanted to do. What is Monica Lewinsky's lawyer going to say about Linda Tripp? Other than the choice words that Monica has for it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they're going to say that's a psychological game, right? She used her friend against her. what could make a person feel more isolated than finding out that the person she thought was her one trusted friend has been cooperating with the government, wearing a wire, taping her, has pictures of them together, to find out that Linda Tripp's cooperating not just today, but has been all along. I imagine psychologically that makes her, Monica Lewinsky, feel very alone. So, look, no one's lying. Does anybody think there's an inconsistent, like a factual inconsistency between Monica Lewinsky's recitation of what happened in the 302? I don't think they're factually inconsistent, right? It's just the government's kind of depicted this way. Ken Starr was offended that somebody used the word help, that she was help. Monica Lewinsky thinks her entire world is falling apart. She thinks she's under arrest. She thinks they're ignoring her request for counsel. She feels like she has no choice. One gold star, and anybody can spot one more issue that the government is going to argue. What if I'm a trial court judge and I say to the federal prosecutor, what about this? She's all alone and she's suddenly worried that she is in the middle of an international scandal. She realizes the severity of the situation that she's in. And how could anything that she did at that point be deemed voluntary? She's a girl against the world.
Even after all of these factors.
Okay, so she, this side of the board, right? So she's staying with them the whole time, not leaving. Yeah?
So what about her business in the bathroom, phone call, and the woman with the child, trying to like further the conspiracy by informing the president that he's going into the perjury trap?
Okay, and what, how, which way does that play?
Well, wouldn't that be that... Well, it's more evidence of her guilt than of the police's okay conduct, I guess.
Yeah, it's probably a really good, well, good depending on which side you're on in this political dispute. Let's just say that things would have turned out differently if she pulled over some mom in a baby stroller and said, I have a conspiracy with the president and you need to call Betty Curry. That probably wouldn't have been a very good idea. But, yeah, it shows her mental state of mind. I'm having trouble kind of tying it into an argument that it makes. I mean, I guess it shows sophistication on her part, right? They might argue that she's not unsophisticated at all if she's thinking about how to prove this conspiracy while she's in custody. She clearly had a, she had a clear head. I guess they might argue that. Yeah.
I would say that that would be good for the government because she's not that intimidated by what's going on. She's continuing to think, well, how do I keep the, how do I save the president?
Yeah, I guess that's right. If she's sneaking off and looking for a phone, trying to plan to save the president, then maybe she's not so distraught after all. Planning. I'm also thinking of a Colorado versus Connolly kind of issue. I can see the government arguing that even to the extent, and again, we're playing with hypothetical where she quote unquote confesses against herself that night, right? And she then tried to argue that she was compelled. I can see the government saying, primarily, like, you know, in their brief, Roman numeral one is going to be this step. Under the totality of the circumstances, what she said was voluntary. But Roman numeral two might be, to the extent it was involuntary in some psychological sense. It was because the pressure of the situation she was in, independent of the government. It was because she was having an affair with the president and she now realized it was going to become public. And that kind of public, you know, punchline, you know, you realize you're going to be ridiculed, you realize, that's very different from anything the government is doing to her. I don't know, I guess that's stretching a little bit, but I can see that kind of argument. Try to argue that we're pressured on her that were separate from anything the government did to her. Right? External pressures that were not state action. More just fears of public power and all that. Anita, are we missing anything else on this? People might have, I find this really interesting. You can take what the government says about it and line it up very much with what she says about it. And they're very consistent. It's just a question of how they're depicted. And what you see under the due process voluntariness standard, this is really what a real case will look like. It's not going to be Monica Lewinsky, you know, it's not going to be the Ritz-Carlton. It's going to be at the side of the street or in the police station with some guy or woman who doesn't have the resources of Monica Lewinsky. But that was always my sense as a prosecutor. I would listen to the testimony in a motion to suppress. Sometimes you could think someone was lying. You know, sometimes the defendant would say, I would never Mirandize, and the police would say he was. But that, believe it or not, is actually pretty rare. Usually the facts were pretty consistent. It was a question of how you saw them. And perhaps the answer is it's a matter of which chair you're sitting in. Right? If you're the interrogator, you see it one way. You think you're being smart and clever and that you're being hands-off with the suspect, but you don't really appreciate the inherent authority that law enforcement has over citizens. If you're the citizen, you feel quite intimidated, even if you're getting water out of a towel and sandwich and soda and all of this stuff. I know I owe you a break, but just very quickly while this is in our head. Because the doctrine on voluntariness is so ambiguous about totality of circumstances, there's lots of rooms for litigation, there's inherent uncertainty whenever you have a stand based on the totality of circumstances. This line of cases, after the court started to use the process to reach confessions, proved to be pretty unsatisfactory in terms of really giving any guidance. It wasn't giving guidance to police about what they were supposed to be doing in interrogations, what they were allowed to do, and what was going too far. It didn't give any guidelines to lower courts about what they should be telling police officers about what was going too far. It just wound up being on a case-by-case basis. And because of that, you start seeing the court as an institution try to come up more with right-line rules. And we'll talk about that, the kind of historical movement away from due process towards Miranda, which is much more about you. All right, so let's take our break until 20 hours.
Thank you.
9:30 when I got up. That was my time. No, I know. But they got it. Yeah, I had to sit down. I could have done that later. I don't teach this. I had pulled out my name. Yeah, I found it peak hours. So, and I had my dog with me. So, yeah, and then I found that I couldn't take it. Because I meant to just walk my dog and then come back. And then when I saw how long the line was, I didn't think I had time. So I was waiting in line with my dog. And someone had told me I could take it in. But they actually make you carry it inside. And he weighed 30 pounds. So it was. Yeah, he's really small, but he's like all my fault. Yeah, so I held him for like, because even one time he decided he was flying, and my arms were getting, the guy behind me was so nice, he kept offering to hold him, but he was dead, and like, the guy had a black coat or something. So they finally let me, where I go back to it, and like, he was out, so I threw him, like, I
yeah, it was pretty funny.
No, okay, that's what we're going to talk about.
Okay. Yeah. We might not get you today.
It gets like hot, cold, hot, cold. Checking for updates on the election. Like there's going to be anything, I know, but. I know. Well, apparently the news, all the news agencies have a, like there's a complete blackout on any exit polls until 5. Right, exactly. The whole election is there a Black Bradley effect or not? So it's going to be an exit poll.
It doesn't matter. Like, I'm out there and, like, I told anybody I didn't vote for Obama. I went and didn't vote for Obama. Thank you, ma'am. Yeah, I
my brother lives in Arizona. He's really excited about voting. He lives in his own state.
That would be amazing.
My brother is pretty moderate. He actually likes the game. That was the tipping point for him. I'm not going to have it. You're not going to.
Initially, like in the Fourth Amendment context, right, before the court held that the Fourth Amendment's exclusionary rule applied to the state, right? Instead, they were using that due process, shock the conscience test to try to reach illegal conduct, sorry, disturbing conduct by state actors, right? Before incorporation, they would look just to due process. There's a similar analogy here where the early due process cases, and just to be clear, there are contemporary due process cases. This is still good case law. Okay? But the early due process cases were before the court has started to apply the Fifth and Sixth Amendments to the state. So really, due process was all they could use, right? It was the only vehicle for the court to use to reach state action. What you see is as time passed, right, after the court had been using due process for about 30 or even 40 years to reach confessions obtained by state police officers, the court started looking for something else, something other than totality of circumstances, something that was more rules-based. And I think the reasons for that, there's a few of them. One is, as I mentioned before, the due process lines of cases gives very little guidance to police officers. Right? Police officers are told kind of this conflicting responsibility, right? On the one hand, good cops are supposed to get confessions. Right? We like that. We think that they've done their job if we get a suspect to confess. On the other hand, they're told, don't overbear someone's will. Don't overcome someone's will. It has to be voluntary. So they're supposed to be getting somebody to say something that's not in their interest, but they're not supposed to do anything that renders it involuntary, right? So they're trying to balance
these two conflicting responsibilities on their own. A second problem is trial courts. We're having a really hard time applying the voluntariness test. One is because the very nature of the test, which is a standard and not a rule, gave trial courts very little guidance, right? It's all about totality of the circumstances, and you weigh certain factors against others. Okay, but on top of that was the problem of recreating what really happened, right? And I think the Lewinsky tape gives you some idea of what that is like. Even if a judge were sitting at the police precinct watching the interrogation, they might have a hard time saying at what point the police officer crossed the line, right? Maybe it's okay to tell him his friend flipped when he didn't, but it's not okay to tell him his dad implicated him. Where's that line? That's one issue. But that would be even if the judge was sitting there watching it, he or she might have a hard time applying the voluntariness test. There's a separate problem of recreating what even happened, right? Explaining to a judge in the motion to suppress what that interrogation even looked like. The police are going to describe it one way. They're going to describe it in this very kind of, you know, cold manner that makes it seem, you know, very sterile and business-like and perfectly respectable, if not friendly. And to the defendant, it's quite emotional. It's terrifying. They feel overwhelmed. They feel alone. They feel incapable of making decisions. Okay. And how do you recreate that for the judge so that they can then apply this test, which is itself a hard test to apply? Okay. So lots of things about the voluntariness standard kept this from being a way to make the cases go away, if that makes sense, right? There was no way, this was not a doctrine that was going to make these cases stop coming up. It just created more litigation. No clear answers about what it was the police were or were not supposed to do. So the court starts reaching for rules. And we talked last Thursday about that 1959 case called Spano, where they kind of used the guy's friend against him and drove him around and all that stuff. Okay. What you see in that case is a concurrence of three justices who wanted to hang their hat on the fact that Spano had already been charged. Right. Well, what we'll learn when we get to the Sixth Amendment right to counsel is once a person has been charged, they have a right to a lawyer under the Sixth Amendment. It's the same right to counsel that people have at trial. Okay, so once they're formally charged, we're kind of in the quid pro quo side of things, right? Where somebody's facing trial, there's a charging instrument, they're a defendant for court purposes. Okay, that's the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. In Spano, you had three justices who wanted to hang their hat on that and say, let's not decide this case on these amorphous due process voluntariness grounds. Let's say that the police had to stop questioning Spano because he was charged and he should have had a lawyer. But that approach did not get a majority. Well, 5 years later, after Spano, in 1964, the court decided two more cases, Messiah versus United States, and more controversially, Escobedo versus Illinois, where again, you see the court reaching for rules, something other than this amorphous standard of voluntariness, reaching for rules and thinking that the rules have something to do with lawyers. The focus is on lawyers instead of the voluntariness of a confession. So in Messiah, and we're going to get to this when we get to the Sixth Amendment, but in Messiah, Messiah, like Escobedo, had been indicted. Messiah, like Spano in the 1959 case. Messiah, like Spano, had been indicted. And a majority of the court in Messiah used the same approach that those three justices used in their concurrence in Spano and said, let's not decide this on voluntariness grounds. This is a right to counsel case. Even though it wasn't at the courthouse, it was during the investigative stage of the case still, because Messiah had been indicted, they said the Sixth Amendment right to counsel applies to that. It applies to an interrogation to a defendant who's already been indicted. Messiah's confession wasn't admissible because he didn't get that lawyer. Escobedo was decided at the same time, or in the same term, as Messiah. And was much more controversial because Escobedo, unlike Messiah, unlike Spano, had not been indicted. had not been indicted. He was interrogated at the police station. It was late at night. He was kept in handcuffs the whole time. He was kept standing. They didn't let him sit down most of the time. But Escobedo happened to have a privately retained lawyer, even though he hadn't been charged yet. And he asked multiple times to speak with his lawyer. And the police lied and said, you know, your lawyer doesn't want to come down here. That's not possible. Okay, the reality is the lawyer was there asking to see his client. Okay, the police were not allowing that to happen. And they never told Escobedo he had a right to remain silent. They never told him about his privilege against self-incrimination. And Escobedo eventually confessed. Well, the court, quite controversially, held that to continue to interrogate Escobedo under those circumstances violated the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. The reason why Escobedo was controversial is because the Sixth Amendment right to counsel only applies to criminal cases, right, to cases. And that doesn't happen until someone's charged, right? And Escobedo wasn't charged yet. And the court intimated in Escobedo that formal indictments should not be required to trigger the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. They were saying that by the time a defendant confesses, that's really, he's done, right? He's toast. He's confessing. That's such an important part of the investigation that by the time he confesses, he's a target. It's the state versus him, and the Sixth Amendment right to counsel should cover that. Now, to be clear, looking at Escobedo now, okay, how many years later? Many years later, 45 years later, something like that. Looking at it from a contemporary perspective, Escobedo doesn't make sense as a Sixth Amendment case. Okay, so preview to the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, which we'll get to next. The Sixth Amendment right to counsel doesn't apply for indictment. Firm rule. Escobedo is an interesting case, though, because it essentially builds a bridge to the Fifth Amendment right to counsel. There is a separate right to counsel that Miranda creates under the Fifth Amendment. Okay. And most people now characterize Escobedo as a Fifth Amendment Miranda-like case, even though the court purported to decide it under the Sixth Amendment. It creates this road to Miranda. But I think what that shows there, that in one term the court decides Messiah and then even tries to stretch Messiah into pre-indictment cases, okay, like Escobedo, shows the court as an institution trying to find rules to govern interrogations and that those rules should have something to do with a role for lawyers. When you look at due process, right, the focus is on the defendant's state of mind. It's voluntary. What's his will? Or is government conduct overcoming his will? The focus of Miranda is quite different. We start looking at lawyers. By the time Miranda came around and the court granted cert in Miranda, people expected it to be a clarification of Escobedo, right? The court in Escobedo created all kinds of confusion. It was unclear why Escobedo had a right to counsel. Was it only because, even though he was unindicted, was it only because he happened to have retained a lawyer? Was it because he asked for a lawyer? Was it because his lawyer was physically present and asking to see him? Was it merely because he was interrogated? Okay, what triggered the Sixth Amendment right to counsel in Escobedo? People expected the court to use Miranda to answer that question. Instead, Miranda did something quite different and instead created a Fifth Amendment right to counsel. Now, to make clear, I'm always talking about the difference between rules and standards, and you guys get sick of it and everything. This is actually a really good example of the difference between rules and standards, because we just got done talking about due process, which requires that confessions be voluntary, right? And you look at that under the totality of the circumstances. That's clearly a standard and not a rule. Prior to Miranda, the Fifth Amendment's privilege against self-incrimination doctrinally looked exactly like due process. What do I mean by that? Well, if a defendant moved to suppress his confession on the basis that it violated his Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination,
he had to show that his statement was compelled, right? No one can be compelled to be a witness against themselves. He had to show he was compelled. The court held in a case called Brown that that meant it had to be involuntary. In other words, these were the same, right? Anything that was compelled for Fifth Amendment purposes would also be involuntary under due process. Anything that was involuntary under due process would also be compelled for purposes of the privilege against self-determination. The doctrines look exactly the same. It was believed to be one and the same. The defendant moved to suppress the confession. It was the same standard, whether he was invoking the privilege against self-determination or whether he was invoking due process. What the court does in Miranda is separate the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination from voluntariness and made clear that a confession could violate the Fifth Amendment's privilege against self-incrimination. In other words, a confession could be compelled without being involuntary for due process purposes. Miranda was extremely controversial. It was 5-4, even from a pretty liberal court. You know, the Warren Court is kind of famous for being this activist liberal court. And even from that court, it was 5-4. Richard Nixon, when he was a candidate for president, promised to fill the Supreme Court with justices who were opposed to Miranda. So, you know, Miranda was one of a political hotbed at the time. A. Fortas, who had been in the majority of Miranda, was supposed to become the Chief Justice, and it was his support for Miranda was invoked as one factor. There were other issues as well, of course, you know the history there, but his vote in Miranda was one factor that arguably contributed to his not being confirmed as Chief Justice. It led to one of the first filibusters in the Senate during a judicial confirmation fight. It was over A. Fortas. And then finally, in 1968, Congress actually enacted a statute, Section 3501, which was intended to reverse Miranda. We'll get to that in a second about why that didn't work. But in any event, Miranda was extremely controversial. The case itself was actually four cases consolidated together for appeal. And what they all had in common was each of the defendants had been taken into custody, three by what we might call formal arrest, right, where they were told they were under arrest. One, it was held to be a de facto arrest, right, something where he wasn't formally told he was under arrest, but it went beyond a Terry stop, a de facto arrest. So all of them were in custody. They were all being questioned in an interrogation room at the police station. They were all questioned incommunicado, meaning, you know, nobody there for them. No lawyer, no friends. In this police-dominated environment, the suspect against his questioners. And in every single case, the suspect had not been informed of their privilege against self-incrimination. They weren't told that they had a right not to speak. And the court uses the Miranda, that cluster of cases that were joined, to really, I think, do three interrelated things. Okay, Miranda's obviously famous for its warning, right, the Miranda warning. But I think for our purposes, we need to know it beyond how you know it on TV. I was talking to my brother. My brother was a federal prosecutor for a really, really long time, and he was calling me because he was getting ready to vote in Arizona and taking a lot of joy in that. And I said, I got to run. I'm going to go teach Miranda. He goes, custodial interrogation, how long can that take? And I said, it takes about 4 hours. He's like, how can you possibly talk about Miranda for 4 hours? I remember there's all the exceptions. And then he goes, oh, yeah, I remember all the exceptions. I mean, but we have to know this stuff beyond just what you see on TV, right? If you just see it on TV, it's about the warning. But I think Miranda really does three things. One is it separates out confessions that are compelled for Fifth Amendment purposes from confessions that are involuntary for due process purposes. In other words, it makes clear that a confession can be compelled in violation of the privilege against self-incrimination, even if it might pass muster under the due process voluntariness test. That's the difference between a rule and a standard. It might violate the rule, the Miranda rule, which we'll get to in a second, without violating this involuntariness standard. So it pulls them apart. And when the court pulls apart the Fifth Amendment privilege doctrine from the due process voluntariness standard, I think you see like this worldview reflected in Miranda. I don't know if you guys got a sense of this just from the language that's used in Miranda. It's a very different worldview. Instead of being concerned only about the reliability of confessions and about, you know, whether we can trust whether innocent people might be implicating themselves falsely, right, which is what due process is concerned with, Miranda is much more about fairness, right? It's protecting the defendant not only from implicating himself falsely, because that's what due process is concerned with. It protects the defendant against implicating himself unfairly. There's this view that there should be more equality. There should be more equity between the defendant, you know, the suspect being held incommunicado, and these police who are using all these tricks, all these psychological ploys. And there's something unfair about that, even if the confession might be reliable. Right? Even if we think we can trust its truthfulness, we still think it's compelled because it's unfair. Okay, so it's pulling apart the Fifth Amendment from due process is one. Okay, two, a second part of Miranda are the warnings that the case is famous for, right? The stuff that you already knew before you took this class. So black letter law, so one is not the same as due process. Two are, and we're going to talk about this for a while, but if the defendant is subject to custodial interrogation, if there's custodial interrogation, there has to be Miranda warning. You guys know what those warnings are, right? Right to remain silent. Anything you say can be used against you. Write to an attorney, even if you can't afford one. If you're indigent, one will be provided for you. Okay. So if the defendant's subjected to custodial interrogation, he gets a warning. And then the third part of Miranda, which is a little less famous, is an actual right to counsel, right? The warnings tell the defendant you have a right to a lawyer, and if you can't afford one, one will be provided for you. That right to a lawyer never existed before. Okay. So in the form of creating this warning, the court actually creates a right to counsel. And one thing I want to be really clear about, it's funny, when I first started teaching Crim Pro, I still had my outline from Crim Pro from when I was a student. I don't know why I had it, because my computer wasn't from, you know, my computer doesn't even work, it didn't even work anymore by that time, but I had a printout of my old Crim Pro outline, and I looked at it when I was starting to teach Crim Pro, and it was pretty good. Like, I had a pretty good understanding of Crim Pro. But the part about the right to counsel under Miranda versus the Sixth Amendment was completely messed up and wrong. So my goal is to have you understand it better than I did when I was a student. And it's confusing because you talk about you have a right to a lawyer. This defendant, Miranda, has a right to a lawyer because he's being interrogated. That is not the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. It is a Fifth Amendment right to counsel. And what the court is doing in Miranda is creating essentially a presumption. It's a presumption that if a defendant is subject to custodial interrogation and is not told about his right to remain silent, that this is the second part of the warning. It's an irrebuttable presumption that what he says, his confession, is involuntary, is coerced, is compelled. Even though it might not be, okay, even though it might pass muster under due process, it's a bright line rule. The underlying concerns are animated by voluntariness. They're animated by concerns about compulsion. Right? They're animated by concerns that this psychological warfare that goes on during interrogations, right, will have somebody say something involuntarily. But rather than have that decided on a case-by-case basis, like with the due process approach,
What Miranda does is set up an irrebuttable presumption that if someone is subjected to custodial interrogation and is not told about their privilege, that what they say is compelled. And compelled statements, that violates the privilege. The third part, this right to counsel, it clears up Escobedo. Right? Everybody was confused by Escobedo because there is no such thing as a Sixth Amendment right to counsel pre-indictment. What the court made clear, kind of implicitly, by deciding Miranda, is that there is a separate right to counsel triggered by custodial interrogation. The Sixth Amendment right to counsel is for the purpose of protecting people at critical stages of their trial. When we get to Messiah, we'll see that interrogations can be a critical stage. What is the Fifth Amendment right to counsel for? I mean, what's the court worried about in Miranda? Why do people get lawyers? If they're not charged yet, right? They don't have a right yet to trial counsel. They are not charged yet. Why does Miranda create? There's nothing in the Fifth Amendment that says anything about lawyers. So why is there a right to a lawyer in Miranda? Yeah.
The person may do something far from the target that will defeat the purpose of the opportunity to counsel or the right to counsel during the pendency of the trial.
No. What do you mean by that?
And that, like, as you mentioned before, if somebody has already done that, then their counsel is going to do is going to be able to do very little in the trial of charge. That time leading up to charging is also critical. So they need someone to help them make decisions during the time leading up to charging.
Okay, so part of this is you could justify it as sort of tying it to the spirit of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel and saying that for trial counsel to be effective and for the defendant to be able to play any kind of active role in helping his lawyer defend him, he can't be making decisions by himself prior to being charged that are going to sink him, like confessing, right? That's going to undermine whatever his lawyer might do for him at trial. And from that perspective, I think it looks like Escobedo. I think that's what the court in Escobedo was trying to articulate as a worldview, is that this affects trials so much that we should extend the right to trial counsel out, right? Pull it backwards into the pre-indictment phase. What the court does here is really, though, create a separate right to counsel that's concerned not really about trials. I think you can defend it sort of undercover, sort of by saying it's based on concerns about trial. But what the court is saying formally is it's for the purpose of helping the defendant decide whether to speak. I mean, I think that's the only way you can defend having a right to counsel in Miranda for Fifth Amendment purposes. Sixth Amendment is concerned about trial. The Fifth Amendment talks about the privilege against self-incrimination at trial. The purpose of Fifth Amendment counsel is to help the defendant protect his privilege against self-incrimination. Right? You read Miranda, and it talks about equities, right? At least that's how I see it. I don't know. Do you guys not see that animated in the opinion? Talking about all of the unfairness. Right? And I started talking about confessions last week, saying people have mixed views on confessions. Some think it's really good. Right? People should confess. Other people feel sorry when they hear about a defendant who's confessed. I think the majority in Miranda feel sorry for people who confess. They think that they were tricked into doing it. They see interrogation rooms as fundamentally unfair. And they're trying to even the score. The Miranda majority pictured a world in which every person subjected to custodial interrogation would have a lawyer with them. Do you really think most people with a lawyer with them at the police station are going to talk? Of course not. I think the majority in Miranda really thought that they were seriously curtailing Miranda, confessions. I think the majority really thought they were seriously changing the landscape of confessions. And they did it in pieces. One is to create this irrebuttable presumption that the confession is compelled if it's unwarned. But importantly, they created a substantive right to counsel that did not previously exist.
that the defendant, if he's going to be subjected to custodial interrogation, has the right to a lawyer to help him decide whether or not to exercise his privilege or whether or not to exercise his privilege. Okay. Okay. In reality, some people, as controversial as Miranda was, some people have said it didn't go far enough. If you were going to pretend that you are the head of a group of defense lawyers, you're going to lobby for legislation that makes Miranda more protected. What more would you want, given how the regime works? Given what's in the warning, given how the document works, how can it be more protected?
Yeah. I mean, this is a matter of formalities, I guess. I'd like to see it be signed or something, like that it's a formal document that is explained and signed your initials. Like, I know some police forms do that, but I know that's not required.
Okay, so one is you might want to have really good proof that the defendant understood his rights and waived them before speaking.
Yes. You could make it a right that could not be waived.
You could make it unwaivable. Some people have said the problem with Miranda is that all it requires is that the person be warned and have a right to counsel, but once they're warned and told they have a right to counsel, they can then waive those rights without talking to a lawyer. Well, and gee, guess what? When we get to the actual doctrine of this stuff, how do we know whether the waiver is valid or not? Whether it's voluntary, and then we're back up here with all these problems, like a due process plan. So the waiver component of Miranda winds up in real life undermining it a lot. I mean, you guys know from watching TV that despite what was supposed to be this big transformational thing that Miranda did, people still confess all the time. Why? Because they're told their rights, they're told that they have a right to counsel, and then they waive. Once they waive, everything looks exactly the same. It just has to be gone. So there's that. It could be an unwaivable right. Some people have said that the Miranda warning should tell defendants that if they remain silent, their silence can't be used against them. Right? Miranda says you have the right to remain silent and anything you say can be used against you. It doesn't tell people that if you remain silent, you can't use that against you. I think a lot of people talk because they think if they don't, they're not all guilty. But they do look guilty. But jurors can't do that against the prosecutors. Can't comment on it. And defendants aren't told that part of it. So some people have said this hasn't gone far enough. The reality is police don't really, this is anecdotally, police really don't mind Miranda. Some see it as making their job easier. It's a bright line rule. They now have guidance about what they're supposed to do. They know that if someone's in custody and they interrogate them, they have to Mirandize them. They still get their confessions anyway, because people waive. And many police think that this actually helps them. Why? Because if a defendant is Mirandized and then says, no, I don't need that, I'm willing to talk about a lawyer, that helps show not only a waiver of Miranda rights, it helps show voluntariness for due process, on the due process grounds, right? It really helps the government show that it's a voluntary confession if the defendant has been told he has a right to remain silent, has a right to a lawyer, and then chooses to talk anyway, okay, without a lawyer. So police actually don't mind this step, and when the Supreme Court heard Dickerson versus the United States on that the old congressional statute that had tried to overrule Miranda, lots of law enforcement agencies actually sent in amicus briefs saying you should uphold Miranda. So let's talk briefly about Dickerson before we say goodbye today. Your case book goes in a certain order that I guess I understand, but I think it makes sense given that I split the reading up for today. You read Miranda and Dickerson for today, and you don't read what happens in between. Okay, so in between the court's original decision in Miranda and then their opinion in Dickerson in 2000, there's a series of cases that we're going to talk about Thursday, where the court just chips away at Miranda. Right? The height of Miranda was Miranda,
And it was only a 5-4 decision to begin with, right? It wasn't this thing that swelled and became, you know, this really accepted thing. The height of Miranda was Miranda. And then the court immediately kind of started chipping away at it. And in this long series of cases that we'll talk about Thursday, the tone of the cases was, the reasoning was very similar. And when we get to it, it's going to look like those Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule cases. Right, when we talked about the Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule, the court said it's a prophylactic. It's not constitutionally required. We only use it as a vehicle to protect what really matters, which is the Fourth Amendment substantive privileges themselves. We just tailor the exclusionary rule as necessary to get deterrence. Okay. What the court did from Miranda to Dickerson was to do a similar thing and to say Miranda is not constitutionally required. Miranda is a prophylactic. What the core of the Fifth Amendment, the real constitutional right, is the privilege to be free from compulsion, right? To not be compelled to be a witness against oneself. That's what the Constitution provides. We, the court, outside the Constitution, have created this prophylactic regime where we assume as fiction, right? We treat as fiction this presumption that testimony, that a confession is compelled if it's the product of custodial interrogation and it's unwilling. That's a prophylactic. So the court kind of chips away and creates all these exceptions to Miranda, which we're going to get to Thursday. Impeachment, public safety, all these exceptions to Miranda. And the rationale was that Miranda is not real. It's not a real constitutional entitlement. It's something we created to protect the real constitutional rights, the standard, to be free from compulsion. We created this rule-based prophylactic. And if something violates the rule but not the standard, unwarranted and yet voluntary, we can mess with it. We can choose to use it. We can let prosecutors use it for impeachment. We can allow a public safety exception. We can create all these exceptions to our rule because it's not real. It's not constitutionally valid.
Well, the court's language of prophylactic rules and it's not constitutionally required, all of this stuff, catches up to the court because it turns out that Congress kind of quietly enacted 18 U.S.C. 3501, a statute that was intended to override Miranda. Congress got upset about the controversial Miranda decision and said that confessions should be admissible as long as they're voluntary. Confessions should be admissible as long as they're voluntary. In other words, the statute sought to equate, right, the Fifth Amendment with due process again. Tried to make it all about voluntariness once again. Getting rid of this irrebuttable presumption of involuntary if it's unwarranted. The decision goes up to the Supreme Court. And interestingly, Rehnquist, you know, it's not written by one of the more liberal justices on the court. Justice Rehnquist writes the majority opinion, and it's a 7-2 opinion. A lot of people thought this was going to be very close. They thought it would be 5-4 and thought it might go the other way. But the court kind of stands by Miranda and reinforces Miranda and says that it is a real constitutional rule. They talk about it in prophylactic terms. You know, Rehnquist has to, I mean, there's so many, you can find a quote in pretty much every post-Miranda case that made it look like Miranda wasn't a real constitutional rule, right? It was an easy brief for the government to write in Dickerson. He waved that all away. Yes, we had language in our cases that suggested it wasn't a real constitutional rule, but it is a real constitutional rule. So Miranda is constitutionally required, which means it can't be overridden by Congress. And what the court does with all of those exceptions, okay, and we're going to get, today's very theoretical, I can see you guys are tired. We're going to get much more into nuts and bolts on Thursday. When we get to all those nuts and bolts, the rationale of those cases is seriously undermined by Dickerson, right? Because the rationale of those cases, if you're giving them a fair reading, really is that Miranda's not a real constitutional right. The rationale goes by the wayside, but the black letter law is still good. And the reason why it's still good is in Dickerson, the court recast all those cases as not being about a prophylactic rule, but us struggling to find the scope of the constitutional right. That was, you know, every right has edges and boundaries, and you've got to muddle through and find the scope of it. That was us trying to figure out the scope of the constitutional right. So the court keeps all of the exceptions to Miranda, but says it's a real constitutional rule. And I think the reason for it is, and I don't know, I like to talk about the court in terms of personalities, and I'm a legal realist, I guess. I don't think it's all about text and all of that stuff. I don't think judges are robots. I think Miranda is such a symbol, right? If Miranda had been, if Dickerson had gone the other way, right, we lawyers would know, well, it was a prophylactic rule and Congress could overcome that by statute and you've got to defer to the legislative branch and blah, 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 separation of powers. We would be able to explain it to people in those terms. What lay people would see is a huge headline that says, conservative court reverses Miranda. And everyone knows Miranda, right? The two opinions, some people can only name one Supreme Court opinion. Most people can name two, Roe versus Wade and Miranda, right? Those are probably, you ask your average person in the mall to name Supreme Court opinions, those are probably the ones they know about. And people would have seen this institution as being, they would have seen the court as being an activist court, but in a conservative way, right? I think that would have been seen as conservative judicial activism, and for no reason. Because law enforcement people were lining up saying, just leave it as is. Miranda doesn't bug us. We kind of like it. Helps us. We get our confession. In reality, cases are not lost because of Miranda. And the court would have taken a huge institutional hit in terms of its reputation, in terms of symbolism, to undermine Miranda. So that's how I see it. You're free to come to your own opinion about why the court did what it did. But I think it's undeniable that for years the court was saying it was prophylactic, it wasn't constitutionally required, and then it turns around and says that, in fact, it is. Okay, we will get to the black letter stuff Thursday. So your assignment for today is, one, go vote, and two, you're reading for... Sorry, I've got to find my results. You're reading for Thursday. Finish block 16... and then read 739 to, sorry, I should have done this before, to 758. Okay? So read the rest of 16 and then 739 to 758.
On podcast tomorrow morning.
I don't know how long it takes to get paid, but however, it's usually pretty fast.
Okay, I'm going to go over. I don't understand what you're saying. It's all about freedom of compulsion. The Miranda, the purpose against self-determination
is the same right that we talked about Thursday.
Okay.
Right? Schmerber and all that. And it makes people, it's a privilege against being compelled to testify against yourself.
Right.
So prior to Miranda, if a defendant argued, hey, that statement, I was at the police station and they made me confess.
Right.
It violated my privilege against self-determination.
Okay.
They had to show it was an involuntary statement. It was compelled.
Right.
Compulsion. That's the same as the due process test. They looked at whether you were arguing this or this, it all boiled down to was involuntary or was instead involuntary.
Okay.
Miranda changed.
Right, the due process and the Fifth Amendment, kind of.
So, well, Fifth Amendment, especially, right?
Right.
14th Amendment,
right?
Right. The due process clause,
right?
This is the privilege against self-determination.
Okay.
But when you looked at what they protected a person from and prohibited the government from doing, it was identical.
Oh, right.
Okay.
Okay.
And does that make sense?
I don't know.
What I know about our data is a lot. And what I know is that if you want to talk to me,